Last Tuesday, some stark messages were delivered to an invited audience, including the island's politicians and senior civil servants, about national security and the climate and nature crisis. If the scientists are right, this year's weather will be the most stable we will experience in our lifetimes, and we need to prepare for significant life-changing events. The main speaker was retired Lieutenant General Richard Nugie.
I was the non-executive director and the author of Climate Change as it Affects the Ministry of Defence and Defence more generally. So in November, we created a thing called the National Emergency Briefing. It was in Westminster and it was designed to make it very easy for Westminster politicians to come to a session, if you like, a talk about the current situation as affects climate change and sustainability, how it affects our economy, how it affects various parts of the economy and the country. It was 10 individual pitches from 10 experts, or at least 9 experts and me. The idea was to not be alarmist, but to just present the facts. And where we thought it would go. And since then, the organisers of that, who are two brothers who were entrepreneurs, made a lot of money and decided to put all their money into this, so this has been their own money, made a film taking extracts from those 10-minute pitches and created a 45-minute film. And what they're trying to do is to create a groundswell of opinion across the nation and across the country of telling people the facts, not what they sometimes hear in the media, not what they sometimes hear from politicians, but the facts as the best experts in the country know it. And out of that, they hope through screening this film and having a conversation after the film that you will end up with better informed people who want to do something about it. And for me, the interesting thing is that actually the majority of people in the UK want to do something about climate change, but just don't know how and don't know particularly what they can do. So this film is sort of aiming towards that and trying to persuade people that there is stuff that they can do, as well as trying to persuade them that actually government and politicians should pay attention to this because it matters to people.
So let's go into some of that evidence then. And of course, the problem that you face in terms of trying to present this evidence is we have, probably for the first time in maybe a century, people switched off from listening to experts and having the ability to find perhaps ill-informed opinion, which backs up their own views rather than being interested in finding well-researched journalism or whatever fact that they can find. So it's difficult these days to define what a fact is because there are so many versions of facts flying around.
I think that's right. And I think misinformation and disinformation are very prevalent in this debate, and I think there's therefore a sense telling the truth alone is not enough. Scientists have been telling us their truth for a very long time now. We're on to COP 31 or something, and so there's a piece here about it's just not enough to give the facts and say this is what's going to happen. What you therefore, I think, need to do is try and create a story, try and create a narrative that is relevant to individuals. I think if you were to say we must do all this stuff to save the planet, most people would turn around and say, OK, fine. The planet's a huge place. There's 8 billion people on it. I'm one person. How can I do that? And so what we really want is to try and persuade people that actually there's something they can do. There's something of use that they can do, and they can use this information. It is information after all, and it is factual, but that in itself is not enough. You need to try and bring it to an individual basis and try and persuade people that there's stuff that they can do. And that's the purpose of the sort of the conversation after the film, is to say, OK, so what's the so what of that? How do we build a community approach? How do we build a conversation that is actually going to have material difference? That, I think, is if you can create a sort of groundswell of movement, then ultimately, ideally, a government of whatever colour will pay attention to it because the people want them to do something about it. That's how government often works. And so this is all designed not just as a presentation of facts, although the film is largely that. It's the whole purpose of it is to get communities thinking, talking to each other and trying to work out what they as a community can do. And I think that's quite important. Because nobody can tackle this on their own, and facts alone don't seem to be enough. I would agree with you.
Interestingly, we had I think that it's an ongoing thing with Civil Defence on the Isle of Man doing road shows where they go round and give gentle advice to people about what they need to do to be prepared in case there is an emergency. Now, how it was described to me by the head of the Isle of Man Civil Defence was, this is just kind of telling people the basic common sense of how their grandparents lived. So some of the things that we need to do are reasonably common sense. It's self-reliance and for an island like ours, which up until possibly 50, 60 years ago was pretty good at looking after itself and didn't rely too much on everything being shipped in on a boat overnight. It's not that big a leap of understanding for people to realise. Well, actually, we're kind of doing a modern version of what we always used to do, apart from the last 50 or 60 years.
So I think that you can put a date on it. It's less than that. I think it's when the Cold War finished and the Berlin Wall came down. So 1989, 1990. As I heard one politician in the UK say just recently, we have overspent the peace dividend. We were a country in 1980s and all the way from the 1940s that was organised. Now, most people didn't realise it, but we were organised around the concept of deterrence, of resilience, of being able to cope with the first punch and we would get back up again. In 1990, that was seen as an expensive way of doing stuff. And you have a combination of increased globalization and trade across the whole world with this concept that actually famously the comment, the end of history, that we're no longer ever going to go to war again. We've matured out of that as a civilization. We're more mature than going to war. I'm sure every civilization thinks that at some point. And therefore we didn't need to spend on the military, we didn't need to spend on resilience, we didn't need to spend on those simple things that actually meant that should something fail, we were able to cope with it. And that was epitomised by the concept of just-in-time philosophy, which came out of Japan. And we, the UK, are probably the greatest proponents of just-in-time philosophy in Europe. The rest of Europe actually didn't go down that route quite so fast as we did. And that is a brilliant way of being more efficient in a peaceful world, in a world where you can pretty much guarantee that if you ask for something on a Monday, it's going to arrive on a Tuesday. That's not the world we live in now. And it's not the world we live in, partly through the geopolitics of the world that's changed. Partly through, I describe climate change as a threat multiplier. It adds fuel to the fire of irregularities, inconsistencies, unpredictabilities. There are enough of those in the world anyway, but climate change just adds something to that to make them more radical. And so we now have the way that politicians describe it, the way that senior commentators describe it, a more volatile world, an increasingly volatile world, where just-in-time philosophies have ceased to be sensible because you end up with a supply chain, particularly for an island, whether it's the island of the UK or the island of Man, where you are utterly reliant on supplies coming into the country, that if you cannot rely on that anymore, you can't rely on just-in-time. And so, as somebody famously put it, we've moved from just-in-time to just-in-case. And so, yes, it is going back to the 1980s and earlier than that, where we need to think about a world where we can't guarantee that just because we ask for it on our iPad today, we will get it tomorrow, because something might get in the way. And if you go down that route of understanding that that's the case, then you might just start to think, OK, so what do I need to do? I need to perhaps think a little bit longer term. I need to perhaps plan against not getting that shipment, but the shipment after. And if you do that, then you start to think of storage, you start to think of redundancy in the way that the word used to be used, which was something having some redundancy meant it had a little bit more than it needed, a little bit of fat in the system to tide over the time when the just-in-time doesn't work. As opposed to redundancy just meaning getting rid of people because you don't need their labour force anymore. And we need to almost reclaim the word redundancy to mean something that allows us to be a little bit more resilient. And actually, the threats from geopolitical situations, the threats from the Straits of Hormuz being closed, the threats from a forming into the great blocks of sort of, you know, Russia, China and America, which is where the world seems to be going, whether we like it or not. A lot of the answers to that, in terms of resilience, also are answers to climate change shocks and climate change threats as well. And so what we should be doing is turning around and saying we need to be more resilient, yes, against a potential threat of a just-in-time not working, but also because climate change might just put a spanner in the works in a way that we do understand. Greater number of storms, more flooding, more drought. That's the way it affects the UK particularly, but that affects our food, energy being cut off. For whatever reason, you know, there are ways of doing it which mean that we're more resilient, and that's where we should be going.
And certainly, I mean, it's not so bad for you in the UK in terms of food security. I think it's something, is it something like 60% in the Isle of Man? We're dependent on about 95% of the food that we eat coming on the boat. Now, that's not that we haven't in the past had the capacity to grow our own food. It's just, as you've described it, it's more convenient, it's more efficient, cheaper is probably the vulgar term that we should use in this case. It's cheaper to just import the food, and basically Manx farmers can't compete with the prices. So we've ended up with a position where we are wholly reliant on the largesse of the UK, if there ever was a food crisis in the world, supplying some of your relatively short supplies to us.
And I think this is, if you take the approach that actually we just need to be a bit more resilient. I understand from things I've read and things I've heard that the UK, for example, because we have adopted a just-in-time philosophy for food, for all sorts of products, we have 2 weeks' worth of food in the UK. It is said that Winston Churchill, in the Second World War, believed that the most damaging effect was if Britain ran out of food during the war. And he said that anything less than 6 weeks' worth of food was insufficient. And he used to get worried if we only had 6 weeks' worth of food. So the very fact that we've got 2 weeks now, Churchill would be turning in his grave. But up until now, since 1990. That's okay, because we've had a just-in-time philosophy that has worked. If you take my argument, which says that the just-in-time philosophy will no longer work in a more volatile and more unpredictable world, where supply chains can be cut at the drop of a hat, either because a tanker gets stuck in the Suez Canal, or the Straits of Hormuz are closed, or the Panama Canal doesn't have enough water because it hasn't rained enough to make... the Panama Canal in 2023 dropped 3 metres as a result of a lack of rain, as a result of climate change. Our supply chains cease to be reliable. And the answer... to Churchill's mind in the Second World War, but to now to our mind, should be, okay, if that is the case, we need to start storing more. We need to start looking for local produce more. I'm absolutely not advocating that either the UK, and I wouldn't dream of advocating for the Isle of Man, but the UK should be self-sufficient in food 100%. That's not actually the right answer. Because then one disastrous harvest or one disastrous storm would wipe out all our food. I'm not advocating that, and I don't think we should be advocating 100% self-sufficiency. What I am saying is we should have more stocks, and we should have very diversified supply chains, so that if a particular food environment, or perhaps call it a sort of a grain silo which we have utterly relied on ceases to operate because of climate change or because of geopolitical loss, then we would survive because we haven't become totally reliant on one supply chain. So diversifying supply chains, having more storage, these are relatively simple things. They're very easy to say, I appreciate. But they're relatively simple things to get your head around, that actually that just makes us more resilient and stronger, and therefore able to withstand the shocks that maybe climate change, maybe geopolitical, but which are likely to come down the road to us more often in the future.
One of the scary statistics that's used in the, well, maybe stark is the word, in the presentation is, I think, around about a 5% reduction in GDP if nothing significant changes, if no action is taken by the end of, over the next 10-year period. 5% doesn't sound like an awful lot in the overall scheme of things. You know, if I lost 5% of our family income, we'd be struggling, but at least we'd still be able to manage. Tell us a bit more about why that 5% reduction is important.
I think I'll be honest. I'm allowed an independent view, if you like. I find it very difficult to translate a percentage reduction of GDP into individual people's experience. We've had inflation at 4.5%. The Bank of England is currently predicted inflation by the end of the year at 6%. That means that is effectively a 6% reduction in our buying power over a year, and that's more than the 5%, and we will all live with it. So what is that statistic getting at? That statistic is getting at GDP, gross domestic product, by having a 5% reduction, what does that actually mean to the individual? Not a huge amount if you're getting on with your day-to-day business. It's not inflation. What it really means is that the government has much less money to spend on the health service, much less money to spend on potholes, much less money to spend on the armed forces, if you choose to go that way, much less money to spend on welfare state. And so a reduction in GDP, it may not be seen by individuals, but what they will notice is that the schools are less good, that the health service is less good, that the roads have more potholes. And my goodness, we're suffering from that at the moment. And so all the things that government puts money into to make our lives as successful as they can be would be reduced because we have a reduction in GDP. That's what it really means. For you or I, Yes, we would have slightly less buying power. It might mean instead of 2 pints in the pub, we only have 1 pint in the pub. That sort of thing is a choice that we can make with the amount of money we have in our wallets. Government, though, is very badly affected by reductions in GDP because it means that they can't spend as much in order to do the things that we want them to do.
Some people listening at the start of the programme might have been saying, well, surely if it's climate change, we should have a professor of climate science talking to us. What on earth have we got a lieutenant general talking to us about this? Why is that?
Well, I'm an individual and I have a view, but actually I think I would not describe myself as an environmentalist. I describe myself as and I do often describe myself as a pragmatic realist, or an optimist even. Climate change is more than just the birds and the bees, if I can put it like that. It's more than just looking at pretty flowers and saying we should have more. Climate change is much more than the environmental aspect of it. It's not polar bears. That, of course, is an aspect of it. And it's how it has been presented to try and grab people's attention in the past. I'm putting it in a very, very different light, and a light that not many people are talking about, which is that actually the first role of government, of any government in any part of the world, is the security of its people. That's why governments came about in the first place, was to secure people, to give them the security to be able to lead their own lives in the way that they wish to. And that varies country to country, but it's our ability to lead the life we in Britain, in the Isle of Man, wish to do so. That's what government's there for, and it tries to make that easy. If I was to turn around and say, as I do, and say that our ability to do that is affected by climate change, my ability as a soldier to defend the country that I've spent the last 35 years defending and make it worthwhile to defend the country that I love, if that is damaged by climate change, if that ability is damaged by climate change, then actually I want to do something about that. And I'm not prepared to sit back and say it's just an environmental problem and I care about polar bears. In a sense, yes, I do, but that's almost irrelevant. I care about the fact that the fabric of my country is at risk if we do nothing about climate change. And for me, that's a security issue. It's a point of view. I don't want riots on the streets. I don't want people running out of food. I don't want our farmers to be unable to farm. I don't want situations where people are being flooded out of their houses every 5 minutes because climate has got so bad that that's what happens, or that we've got extraordinary drought. Because at the end of the day, it changes the fabric of our society that I've spent the last 35 years defending.
And I guess this whole impact of climate change on the economy, and as you've eloquently described, that ultimately the big hit there is government expenditure. So at a time when climate change is making more and more parts of the world less and less hospitable, and more people from those countries are eager to find somewhere else to live, we're also less able to send money to those countries by way of international development aid to help them adapt to the climate changes in their own countries.
That's absolutely right, and I would say that cutting international aid, where international aid can help people cope with their own climate crises in their own countries, is not the most sensible thing to do, because the last thing we want is all those people wanting to come here. And I'm both sides of my family were migrants over the last 150 years. I am the product of two migrant families, one from France and one from Poland. But the reality is that whilst I think that migration is a very good thing, huge numbers of people coming to any country doesn't matter which country, will overwhelm that country's capability to be able to cope with it. And therefore, we need to, instead of stopping them at the channel, which is the sort of answer everybody comes up with, we need to stop them moving in the first place. The way you stop them moving in the first place is by adapting what they're doing in their own countries, by helping them to adapt their agriculture, to adapt their water sources, to adapt their ability to live in their own country so that they never feel the need to want to come to somewhere else. And so there's a really important aspect of the causality between climate change making people unable to farm, and we saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan, where I spent quite a lot of my time. The farmers were the people who were in the Taliban and in ISIS and in Somalia, in al-Shabaab. Why the farmers? Because they couldn't farm anymore, but they still needed to put food on the plates of their family. So those organisations, non-state actors, for want of a better phrase, would pay them to join their cause. They weren't ideologically against the West or against the government or whatever. They were ideologically trying to provide food for their families. That is a concern to us, but much more of a concern is if they then decide, well, actually, no, I'm not going to join a non-state actor. I can't stay where I am. I'm going to go elsewhere. And they start to think about, well, where else in the world is not being affected so much by climate change and where I could get a living? They'll never present themselves as climate change refugees or climate change migrants. They won't say, I'm a product of climate change, because people don't think like that. They'll come as economic migrants saying, I can't live in my country. I want to live somewhere better. And that's almost the definition of an economic migrant. And so that's another aspect of climate change is fueling things that were probably happening anyway. But it's fueling, it's adding fuel to the fire, it's making it more extreme. And as a result, funnily enough, our politics is becoming more extreme, almost as a direct result, across the whole of Europe and across America. You know, President Trump in his first term, build the wall, you know, became the great cry. This is exactly what he's trying to stop. And I would agree, you know, millions and millions and millions of people wanting to come to Europe because it's a better place than where they can't make a living elsewhere. We need to somehow accommodate or stop that, and the way that you do that is by helping them in their hometown, not by trying to stop them across the channel.
You described yourself earlier as an optimist, and by golly, you need to be. Over the last 30 or 40 years, we've had various meetings, climate conferences, people coming together, making it very clear to anyone who's prepared to listen that unless something is done, big policy changes to address the amount of carbon, particularly that's being pumped into the atmosphere, we are heading into really troubled times, particularly in relation to climate. And yet, we haven't even reduced the amount of emissions over that time. If anything, the emissions continue to go up. You really do have to be an optimist to think that this can be solved.
So there's two sides to that. At one side, the sort of flippant answer is, what's the opposite of optimism? It's pessimism. What's the opposite from doing something? It's doing nothing. Where does doing nothing get you? It gets you absolutely nowhere. And you end up despairing because you hear all these really bad stories and everything. You end up despairing and saying, well, I can't do anything and I'm not going to do anything. And it's a spiral downhill. So that's the opposite of optimism. So in a sense, as a flippant answer, I'd rather be on the positive side than the negative side. But there's a different side to it, which is I strongly believe, and perhaps it comes from my background, that there are ways through this. It will be a muddle. It will be difficult. It will rely on a lot of technology. I mean, AI has the potential to do some enormous good here. I don't know what that looks like because I'm not an AI expert, but there are technologies that will help us. Look at the cost of wind. Look at the cost of solar. It's come down really dramatically, and the effectiveness of solar and wind has gone up really dramatically in the space of a very, very few years. We are trying to do something that has never been done before. If you look at oil, oil is the most successful, the most brilliant energy that we have ever invented as humans. It took 70 years for oil to become ubiquitous across the world. So from about 1880 to 1950, broadly speaking. And every energy source that we have ever invented, whether it's nuclear, whether it's wind, whether it's fire, whether it's oil, whether it's hydro, whenever it was invented, we still got it. We're trying to do something absolutely fundamental in two ways. One is we're trying to reduce the most effective, not necessarily the best for the planet, it definitely isn't, but the most effective energy source that we have. We're trying to reduce that because of the damage it's doing. And we're trying to do it in half the time it took to adopt it in the first place, in 30 to 40 years. Both those are really, really difficult. But by the very nature of the fact that we have invented extraordinary things, humans are extraordinarily adaptive, I am completely confident that if we understand the need, and that, after all, is what this film is about, then we can do it. We can do it if our backs are to the wall. We are really good at responding when our backs are to the wall. It's the classic of a lot of innovation comes out of war, when it is, you know, it's the mother of all necessity, is having to do something to win a war if in those cases. I think we're getting close to that point where we start to realise that this is an emergency, that actually we are facing real danger, and that therefore we ought to do something, and that those technologies and that innovation and that human creativeness will come to the fore. That's why I'm an optimist.
Well, I can share a small anecdote. When I was forestry minister in the 2008, there was a massive increase in oil prices. And I know this because we were supplying timber for fuel. That year, something like 25% of households on the Isle of Man fitted wood-burning stoves because it was cheaper than using oil. And I suppose the optimism there is it shows that when there is a financial imperative to change, people will make that change because it'll be the sensible thing to do. So,
and I hope I've got my facts right, but it's something like there's a 50% increase in the sale of solar panels in the UK since the Straits Formers have been closed, and the price of oil has gone through the roof. I remember somebody saying to me about 10 years ago, the price of oil will never get over $100 a barrel. We're I think even today we're well over $100 per barrel, and that means that. People are looking for alternatives already, and they're shifting their behaviours already. So lots of people are suddenly buying solar panels. The number of EVs that we're selling across the UK is disproportionate to where we thought we would be if it had just been a better car. It costs me, even with quite expensive electricity, it costs me less than half to run my EV than it would if I was filling it up with petrol. And that's without the price going up. Now the price has gone up, it's about a third. People notice that in these sorts of environments. And they act. And they act in a way that... if you've driven an EV, and just as an aside, it's a lot more fun than driving a petrol car. It's a lot easier, and it's a much smoother ride on the whole. So once you've got into an EV, most people say, oh, I didn't know it was quite this good, and stay in it. So yes, shocks will get us places. And I think that's really important. But it gives me a confidence that eventually you'll get a momentum going, and that we will, and that's why I'm optimistic that we will get that momentum going and that people will react.
Well, if people have listened positively and are feeling optimistic after all this, how do they find out more?
So the on the particular national emergency briefing, it's been turned into the people's emergency briefing. Go along to a community screening. I understand there are a number on the island that are going to take place. There's one today. But just Google the national emergency briefing and you can find out more. Look for people's emergency briefing community events, which are happening. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is just become interested, become curious about it, and start sort of thinking about things and look on the internet for some of the facts and figures. They're all there. It's really obvious. And then you'll find that if you're anything like me, you'll be drawn into some of the really interesting things that are going on in the world that you don't notice if you don't look for it.
And a final question, top tips. What are the things that you would encourage people to at least consider doing in the course of the next few years?
So I look at what is costing stuff that is costing you because it's the way you've always done it, as opposed to looking for new ways of doing it. None of us like change, but actually if that change can help you. So for example, I've put some solar panels on my roof. I've got a house battery. It has reduced my energy bills very substantially indeed. That's one alternative. I'm actually looking at the moment for a little wind turbine that I can put on my house. You know, that sort of thing, little things like that. Think about doing things that you've always done, but actually, is there a better way of doing it? And then there's another side to it, which is try and reduce waste. We used to have a funny thing called a milk bottle. And the milk bottle would go back to the milkman after you've used it. It was actually 1950s, 1960s recycling. And little things like recycling, upcycling, if you want to call it that, things, trying to think through how you can reduce the amount of waste. All of that is beneficial. Why? Because it reduces the amount of energy that is required to create it in the first place. I'm constantly amazed that when the very small tax came in, I think it was 5p on a single-use plastic bag, in the UK we went from ubiquitous use of plastic bags to a 75% reduction almost overnight, and it was for the sake of saving 5p a bag. Little things like that actually make a difference. It changed people's behaviours because there was an incentive to do so. So looking at how you run things in your own life and say, is there a way I can make this more efficient, more effective, I think is what you could do. And there's technology that can help you, yes. The smart meters that all the energy firms want you to adopt. It tells you on a day-to-day basis how much electricity you're using. You suddenly think, oh, well, if I turn that off, that will go down. I save money. I think it's ultimately about trying to think through your own life how you save money that will also have a byproduct of helping with reductions in carbon emissions and things like that.
That was retired Lieutenant General Richard Newgie. So what did the CEO of the Manx Wildlife Trust, Graham Makepeace Warne, make of the presentation?
First of all, it's utterly shocking. No matter how many times I see this information, it never stops to really hit home just how much of a problem we're facing as an island, as a globe. But also the urgency of it. You know, it's an emergency briefing. That urgency is really, really quite apparent now. We first declared, Clare Barber declared a climate emergency in the Isle of Man in 2019, 7 years ago, and we're still not really delivering. We've got a very good net zero team, they've got a budget, but as an island we're not really delivering on that promise to reduce our carbon footprint.
I mean, there are causes for optimism, but most of the film was about some fairly stark facts about where, you know, even if our climate isn't going to be too badly affected, there are going to be significant impacts quite soon on many, many parts of the world, which is going to impact our lives because we won't be able to get as much food. There'll be more people wanting to come and live in our part of the world. All of these issues that are going to affect us.
Well, actually, I don't quite agree. I think although in the Isle of Man we won't see the extremes of temperatures that other countries will, we are already seeing the impacts of climate change, so changes in our weather patterns. So you know, the farmers will often complain about the weather, but really the last few years for them have been very, very difficult. They've either had springs that are too dry, too wet, too hot. And it's because we're getting longer periods of one type of weather. So we had a very, very wet winter. You know, Mark from the DOI talking about flood risk in the Isle of Man mentioned how wet this winter was. But now it's really dry, isn't it? We've had 2 weeks or more now of hardly any rain, and it's really, really dry. So those are the sort of things that are going to affect us. From a nature point of view, we're already seeing things where the food plants for certain invertebrate species, certain insect species, are coming out at a different time to the emergence of that species. So they have no food when they emerge. And that's because of changes in our climate. So it's already affecting us right here in the Isle of Man.
You did have yourself some positive messages at the end, because everyone was asked at the end, what are the things that give you hope?
Well, I said in my answer to that question, people, because people do drive things. And I think if people can go out there, get together, create community groups that can create local community gardening projects, grow food, reconnect themselves with nature and understand where food comes from, I think that can be really powerful. But actually, the thing that really gives me hope is nature itself. It is the solution. It costs very little to plant trees. That reduces our flood risk, it reduces our wildfire risk, it creates amenity space, it's good for our physical and mental well-being. And that's just one example. There's so many others.
And what would have to change? What if you were allowed to pick one thing, what would make your life as CEO of Manx Wildlife Trust so much easier?
I think we need a political system and MHKs who are willing not to listen to the very noisy minority and are willing to make big, bold decisions that are right for the island and right for our sustainability.
That was CEO of the Manx Wildlife Trust, Graham Makepeace-Warne. Finally, some economic optimism.
I'm Dominic Wall, and I'm a sustainable finance and ESG advisor at the Isle of Man Financial Services Authority.
Money, the sort of big money that is invested around the world, can have a fairly dramatic impact on things like climate behaviours. How can the Isle of Man be involved in that kind of influence?
In terms of the financial sector, there's a lot of flow that comes through the Isle of Man, and I think that's often overlooked. I mean, one of the statistics I kind of referenced on the panel tonight was that there was a campaign by Make My Money Matter, which was in partnership with Aviva and Reuters. And that kind of states, based on their study, that switching your pension to a sustainable or green fund is 21 times more effective than reducing your carbon footprint through flying or becoming a vegetarian and switching to renewable energy combined. So, you know, and also, you know, if you look into the data, the volatility and the returns of those kind of investments, they have a decent track record when comparing to traditional investments. So it's not like you're necessarily losing return on your pension. But there's a huge nature and climate funding gap. It's going to take public and private financing bridge that gap.
You, like most of the rest of the audience, saw the film, I presume, for the first time. What was your reaction, I suppose, to the film?
I think it was a mixture of there was a lot of emotions, very emotional, but at the end it definitely was very motivating. They presented a lot of solutions in the Yeah, in the film, and also there's a lot of solutions. We already have them. You know, we have the frameworks in place in terms of disclosure for companies. We have the natural capital accounting and carbon accounting frameworks. It's just about how we kind of implement it into policy, proportionally, of course, when it comes to the Isle of Man. But we have the solutions. It's just about implementing now.
Does the financial world, the global financial business, does it understand the nature of this emergency as it's being described here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in terms of the World Economic Forum tells us that global GDP, gross domestic product, is 50% of it is moderately or highly dependent on nature. So, you know, it's half of the world's GDP. And according to the Green Finance Institute, this was actually referenced in the film, that the deterioration of the UK's natural environment could lead to an estimated 12% loss in GDP over by 2034. So, you know, how does that compare to, let's say, the global financial crisis? The global financial crisis, there was 5% drop in GDP, and the COVID-19 pandemic was 11%. So we're really looking at the most significant crisis we've ever faced. And kind of when people say we can't afford to invest in nature and climate, it's quite absurd, because it's a very system that supports all the economic activity.
Why do you think it is so difficult to solve this problem? I mean, the evidence seems to be pretty clear. The financial solutions seem to be pretty clear. It would appear that by going down the route of a more sustainable future, the places we live will be better places. Why is it so hard, do you think, for the right decisions to be made to make the shift?
You know, I think it's long-term thinking. It's framed as a very long-term problem, although we've seen the severity and the occurrence of climate change risks happen quicker than we thought now. So, you know, one, it's long-term, I would say. Two, people don't like change. And then also, you know, just to kind of follow on that point is, we need to really think about, have a change in kind of systems thinking. One way is that we don't really value natural capital on businesses' balance sheets. So when you value, you know, when a company has property on their balance sheet, they don't necessarily value the nature on their land. They might just see it as unused land. Whereas it may be a forest, it may be wetland, which can be seen as kind of a natural capital stock, like any stock, you know, it can gain value. And then also on top of that, you can have ecosystem services, which can be seen as income. So, you know, both natural capital stock and ecosystem services aren't correctly valued by businesses, and that's an example of the system change that we need to see in terms of economics.
We heard from the Lieutenant General Nuji earlier in the proceedings that businesses in Exeter were flooded, so businesses in Exeter invested in a tree planting scheme further up the river. And as a result, Exeter isn't getting anywhere near the amount of flooding as it used to.
Absolutely, you know, and that's the whole beauty of nature-based solutions is you're restoring nature, which has declined by 73% from 1970 in terms of the species, that also sequesters carbon. So you're solving the climate crisis and the nature crisis. And, you know, just to go on, there's been a lot of kind of global wars, I would say, or wars occurring around the world at the moment. Just to kind of bolt onto that theme of national security, you know, we have a huge history of actually funding wars. The public would actually fund wars through war bonds. And you know, they would provide patient cheaper capital to support the UK's defence. And I think it was all behind getting. It was all because people could get behind a mission. So I think if we could sell the climate and nature crisis as getting behind a mission, which is critical, we could all fund it that kind of way, and in that kind of that same kind of effort with doing blue bonds, green bonds, etc. So there are mechanisms to kind of bridge that huge funding gap of it's $9 trillion annually in terms of the climate, and then in terms of nature, it's $342 billion a year that we need in dollar terms.
That was Dominic Wall, Sustainable Finance Advisor at the Isle of Man Financial Services Authority. So what do you think? There's no doubt that many well-trained and experienced scientists are deeply concerned about the increasing pace of change in our climate. If they're wrong and we follow their advice, we will spend money unnecessarily but end up with a less polluted world. If they're right, but we do nothing, our future on this planet looks pretty bleak. Will the presentation convince the sceptics? Probably not. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. I'm Phil Gorn, gudamaiyos ungeisiachrom. Thanks for listening.